From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, a special prosecutor is looking at Governor Rick Perry and going to a grand jury. Could Perry be looking at an indictment? As Wendy Davis and Greg Abbott race for the governor's office, the issue of statewide pre-K jumps to the head of the class. And the State Board of Education ducks on the question of a statewide curriculum on Mexican-American studies. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Governor Rick Perry frequently complains about government overreach when it comes to Washington, D.C., but the question, did Perry overstep his authority, is the center of an investigation by a special prosecutor, and it appears Perry could be indicted on charges related to coercion and abuse of official capacity. Craig McDonald is the executive director of Texans for Public Justice, a government watchdog organization, which filed the complaint against Perry, sparking the investigation.
We filed a complaint shortly after the governor vetoed the public integrity unit's budget on June 15th. That veto followed a threat to the Austin Travis County District Attorney, Rosemary Lemberg, that was pretty public. The threat was published on the front page of the Austin American-Statesman. Perry issued it 5 days before the veto, and essentially said to Rosemary Lemberg, who of course is not an employee of his, doesn't work for the state, doesn't work for the governor, but he essentially said to her, if you don't quit your job by Friday at 6 o'clock, I'm going to veto the budget of the Public Integrity Unit. She refused to quit in the face of his bullying. He went ahead and vetoed $7 million budget item, which funds the Public Integrity Unit, the only unit in the state, we might add, that is charged with investigating and prosecuting criminal political corruption. It's a unit that we've turned to many times in our watchdog role. And so we were a little outraged, not only outraged, but we thought that his threat, not his veto, we understand he's got the power to veto any bill, any piece of legislation that he wants. We don't challenge that authority. What we took issue to was his threat, his coercion to veto the budget unless the Travis County District Attorney resigned. So we researched the law. It took us a few days to research the law, and we found a relevant law that basically deals with offenses against public administration. That's a law that says a public servant can't coerce another one through the threat of a public act. I think some elements of the bribery statute might be in play here. So we filed an official complaint. And as you mentioned, that complaint, the judges here in Travis County, as well as the prosecutors, rightfully recused themselves. The presiding circuit judge appointed Burt Richardson from San Antonio, a retired judge, to handle the case. Mr. Richardson then went and appointed a special prosecutor, who was a former federal prosecutor, Michael McCrum, and that prosecutor has been investigating our charges ever since he was appointed to the case in late August.
But there's still a lot more going on than what you described. Governor Perry asked for or demanded the resignation of Travis County District Attorney Rosemary Lemberg. He wanted that resignation for a particular reason. What was his public reason for that?
Well, I think his public reason was pretty vague. It was that she'd been charged with a drunk driving offense. And his public reason, I guess, was on moral grounds. He said that the people of the citizens of Travis County deserve better. We don't believe that for 1 minute. We believe he vetoed it for political reasons. Had she resigned her job, he would have been able to appoint a Republican district attorney to fill out the term. And also, the Public Integrity Unit at that time was investigating potential felonies in the governor's cancer prevention unit. And since indictments have been brought down. So, well, he told the people, the citizens of Texas, that he did it, quote, for moral reasons or ethical reasons. Again, we can't get inside of his mind and know why he did it unless we see the memos which maybe we will in the near future.
So Rosemary Lindbergh was caught on tape. I mean, she was arrested. She was really in her cups. She was her drinking was way over the level, the legal limit for alcohol consumption while operating a car. She has to prosecute people who get DWIs. She did plead guilty to the offense, but that is not good for the DA to be out there drinking and driving.
That may not be good, but the process is not to have the governor bully into quitting her job. She went to jail for that offense. She was actually another legal action was brought before a judge. She stood trial, if you will, to see if she was competent to continue in the role of district attorney. That judge found her to be totally competent. And it's the voters of Travis County that need to hold her accountable, not the governor, who may have other political motives. And so, the law is pretty clear. And while we don't defend Rosemary Lindbergh's actions at all, never have, nor do we challenge the governor's right to veto her budget, we do take concern and take notice when we believe the governor overstepped his authority in this instance.
Well, Governor Perry has been governor for over a decade now, and during that time we've had other public officials be arrested for DWI or other improper acts. Is that something that he normally does when we have a public official in Texas be arrested, that he will make an announcement demanding their resignation?
Well, you know, I'm not totally informed on that. I don't recall a situation, but that doesn't mean that there hadn't been one. I certainly haven't seen him as outspoken as he was in this incident. And you can challenge his motives on this as well by the fact that his party, the Republican Party, has tried to eliminate the Texas Public Integrity Unit for years and years. It's been part of the Republican Party platform committee, or their platform. So this is something that's been on the list of things that are, if you will, a pain to those in political power. It has prosecuted Republicans and Democrats for political corruption.
So where are we on this investigation into CPRIT, the cancer fund? You know, Texans voted to approve $2 billion to fund that, over promises that this would help fund cancer research in Texas, in which politics would not be involved, and now we're finding out that politics was involved.
Yeah, well, that investigation, I believe, has come to a close from the Public Integrity Unit. They have filed felony indictments against one of the former CPRIT officials, and I think they had announced that their investigation will stop there. So one of those officials wrongfully approved a grant outside of the normal channels, and I believe that's as far as the CPRIT investigation will go. The question is, was this veto related to that? Only the governor knows. The investigation of CPRIT was ongoing when the governor wiped out the budget for the Public Integrity Unit.
And so the special prosecutor, Michael McCrum, he can't go into specifics, but he says he is very concerned with what he has found so far. It has led people to believe that an indictment could be coming out of this connected to the governor's office. Is that your read?
That's our read as well. Of course, no one knows except Mr. McCrum. Mr. McCrum did talk to the press briefly, if you will. I think he only spoke to one news outlet. And as you say, he said he was very concerned about what he'd found in his investigation. He also said he was going to take those findings to a grand jury later this month. The grand jury will be seated on or about April 15th, and he will take his findings there. We think that means he's going to seek a felony indictment. Prosecutors don't usually take findings of their investigation to a grand jury unless they have evidence that a felony has been committed.
And you mean an indictment against Governor Perry?
That would be our speculation, yes.
It couldn't come at a worse time for someone who is looking at trying to launch a presidential campaign.
I think that's probably right. This will not be, if this happens, this will not be a good press day for Governor Perry.
There are folks who are saying that's why this is happening, that this is politics trying to spoil Governor Perry's launch of his presidential campaign.
No, I don't. I reject that, and I think the prosecutor would reject that. You know, Michael McCrum is a prosecutor with a stellar reputation of being nonpartisan, if you will. He's been a federal prosecutor for many years. He's worked both for Republican candidates and for Democratic candidates. I believe he's a registered Republican, if I'm not mistaken. And I think he and Judge Burt Richardson from San Antonio, who is overseeing this case, both have a pretty stellar record of integrity and nonpartisanship. So I think it's just the chain of events that might catch up to Governor Perry at a most inopportune time for him. It's not because this has been planned out or a conspiracy from his enemies at all. He's the one who broke the law, we believe, on June 15th, and the consequences of that will come to fruition in due time, not because it's a conspiracy to hurt the governor's chances for the presidency.
Craig McDonald is the executive director of Texans for Public Justice. They filed the complaint against Governor Perry, which launched the special prosecutor's investigation into his veto of state funds for the Travis County Public Integrity Unit. A statement from the governor's office said, as he has done following every session since he's been governor, Governor Perry exercised his constitutional veto authority through line item vetoes in the budget. Many school districts are ramping up efforts to enroll more eligible children in pre-kindergarten. The push comes as gubernatorial candidates Greg Abbott and Wendy Davis spar over who has the better plan for early education. KERA's Shelley Koffler looks at what children are learning inside one Dallas pre-K classroom and what changes the candidates would make in that program.
It may seem like they're just playing a game, but these four-year-olds, keeping time with rhythm sticks, are developing their motor skills and learning to follow instructions.
Look at what I'm doing.
And as they put the sticks away, they practice counting.
Two, three, four, five.
Then pre-kindergarten teacher Sarah Tinsley moves on to the alphabet, giving each of her 13 students a card with a letter on it.
Now I want them to tell me, okay, A says A, and apple starts with A.
For most of these pint-sized scholars, this exercise is a breeze.
M says meal. I am invisible.
Invisible, great word.
They learn their colors, they learn their shapes, they learn their number recognition and quantity. By the time they leave pre-K and kindergarten, they are ready to learn how to read from the very first day of kindergarten.
Tinsley follows a special curriculum approved by the state that's designed to prepare her students for kindergarten and beyond. That's required in districts like Dallas that want to receive state funding for their programs, and most do. But Texas does not mandate a specific course of study for pre-kindergarten, and it's one of just four states that does not require teachers to measure pre-K student achievement and report it to the state. Republican gubernatorial candidate Greg Abbott says he'd change that.
The problem with most taxpayer-funded pre-K programs is that they provide no provable, lasting, measurable results.
Under Abbott's plan, districts could continue to receive the same amount of money for providing the required half-day of instruction, free of charge, to qualified students. That includes four-year-olds from the lowest-income families, homeless children, and children with parents on active military duty. Abbott would offer extra money to districts that meet what he calls a gold standard. It would include a rigorous curriculum and a way of measuring and reporting student achievement. What Abbott doesn't call for is an expansion of pre-K. Opponent Wendy Davis does.
I will ensure that every eligible Texas student has access to quality full-day pre-K.
Davis says she wants to increase the state's half-day requirement to a full day because research shows children in quality programs are more likely to read on grade level and eventually graduate. She also wants to make pre-K available to children from families who earn a little more and are willing to pay based on their income. Abbott says her plan is too costly. She says available federal money and an expected surplus in state revenue would pay the tab.
It's time for Texas to support investments like this. And we can cover full-day pre-K for $750 million annually.
Three, four, five.
One of the candidates' biggest slugfests over pre-K has focused on Abbott's call for assessing what these four-year-olds have learned and how that would be done. Davis jumped on a paragraph in Abbott's plan that says standardized testing is one way of doing that. Abbott insists he doesn't want that kind of testing for four-year-olds. Teacher Sarah Tensley isn't required to test her students, but she says she does, though they may not know it.
It's a fun game. It's a time to sit down with Ms. Tensley one-on-one right next to me, and I'll ask them their alphabet, I'll ask them their numbers, and they get to show me what they learn.
Tensley, who's taught in public and private schools, is so passionate about the benefits of early education, some of her recommendations go beyond what the candidates suggest. She believes the state should mandate pre-K for all Texas children, not single out the poor. A report by the Pew Charitable Trust says 49% of the children who do not recognize letters of the alphabet when they enter kindergarten are middle income or higher. Shelley Koffler, KERA News.
All right, sit down.
The Texas State Board of Education voted 11-3 this week to add elective courses to public high schools that include special topics in social studies, to include Mexican, African, Asian, and Native American studies. The vote was the result of a drive to create a state curriculum and standalone course in Mexican American studies. And while that didn't happen, supporters of the measure say they are more than pleased with this outcome. Dan Quinn is the spokesperson for the Texas Freedom Network, which advocated for the Mexican American Studies class.
They decided preliminarily, they have to come back Friday for a final vote, but they decided that they would ask publishers to submit instructional materials for courses that schools might want to teach on Mexican American studies, African American studies, Native American studies, and Asian American studies. And if schools chose to offer these classes, they would do so under this sort of broad set of curriculum standards called special topics in social studies. School districts have used those broad standards to create local courses for a long time now. The thing that's different about that is if there's a state adoption of instructional materials, that makes it a lot easier for school districts to offer such classes. Because in the past, if you want a special topics course, the school district has to create its own curriculum, create the course on its own. And many districts just don't have the resources, I think, to do that, or they feel they don't. And so that's really kept, I think, the number of these courses down fairly low.
So this would be an elective course. This is not a mandatory course. How does that work?
Well, it's not even going to be a state elective course. They've left it up to local districts to decide whether or not they want to create such a course through the special topics standards set up. So these would be local courses developed. The board is going to decide on later on in the summer whether or not these would be worth a half credit or a credit toward graduation. But these would, at the local level, they'd also be as elective as the state courses are. So I guess the key thing here is it's not a state course, which a lot of us who are advocating for this course wanted, because that would make it even easier for school districts to offer these courses, because it would provide more specific curriculum standards. It would also help publishers be more confident about a larger market, so they would create materials for this. But make no mistake, it's an important step forward. I mean, just remember 4 years ago, this state board was debating whether American heroes like Cesar Chavez and Thurgood Marshall and Dolores Huerta, even Sonia Sotomayor, should they be in the curriculum standards? And so 4 years later, we now have the state board making it easier for school districts to offer courses that teach the full history of this country and how people from a variety of backgrounds have contributed to our history and culture. And that's important.
As an elective mm-hmm. class, this would be something that would be available to upper level, like if you're a junior or a senior and you've already taken care of your basic history?
That would be up to the local school district to decide at what grade level to offer it, or even to offer it at all.
So why are you advocating for this? Why isn't the standard Texas history, U.S. history, world history stuff, why isn't that enough?
The truth is, the contributions of Mexican Americans and African Americans and others to our nation and our history, our culture, too often they've received very little coverage. I mean, that's been a big part of the debate at the state board, and not just in Texas, but across the country for decades.
Well, then why not just fix that in that coursework? Why do you have to create a whole new class?
Well, I think that the important thing is that we do both. Not everyone's going to take these special courses. Many school districts won't even offer them. So we do have to make sure that more coverage is provided to the contributions of Mexican Americans and African Americans, women and others, in the core social studies courses that nearly everyone will take. But even those courses aren't going to be able to provide a really in-depth study of these of Mexican American history and culture in this country.
Dan Quinn is the spokesperson for the Texas Freedom Network, which helped push for a statewide public school Mexican American Studies course. The Texas Board of Education sidestepped voting Wednesday on the proposed course as a high school elective. Instead, it is simply asking publishers to submit textbooks for such a class and several other ethnic studies topics by the 2016-2017 school year. And it is allowing local school districts to develop their own ethnic studies programs. Recovery efforts are continuing weeks after a barge accident in the Houston Ship Channel dumped thousands of barrels of oil into the Galveston Bay. But some are worried that the cleanup itself could disturb the delicate ecosystem and endangered wildlife along the Texas coast. For State Impact Texas, KUT's Mose Bouchel went to the Aransas National Wildlife Refuge to see the cleanup firsthand.
When you walk down the beach on Matagorda Island, there's kind of a sense of disconnect. If you look towards the ocean, it looks pretty idyllic. You know, you see birds often, you see the waters. Maybe way off in the distance you make out an oil rig, you know, just to indicate that, hey, we're still here in Texas, right? But if you turn inland and look towards the land, you see a lot of evidence of all of that activity. Hard hats, all sorts of buoys and stuff that's washed in from all the activity, from barges, from the rigs. I even think I saw an oil drum earlier today. And now most recently, what's washed in is oil itself.
Removing it from the beach is tricky. On a tour overseen by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I saw workers meticulously scraping thin, oil-drenched layers of sand from the coastline.
You can think it of as those that have lived up north where there's snow. The snow is the oil, not that thick. The driveway is the good sand underneath, and you just want to take the bad stuff and get rid of that and leave the good sand. We don't want to dig up the whole beach here. That's not what we want to do.
That's the Coast Guard's Randall Agreziak. He's one of the coordinators for the spill response. That concern that the cleanup could cause harm on top of the spill itself is not limited to sand. This thin barrier island is part of a national wildlife refuge. It's not meant for people. Now, it's home to ATVs, bobcat excavators, dump trucks, helicopters, and hundreds of response personnel. They and the oil are all here right as migratory animals are passing through.
The oil spill could not have happened at a worse time.
Nancy Brown is a spokesperson for U.S. Fish and Wildlife. She says birds are especially vulnerable.
What happens is you have these birds that have migrated literally across the Gulf of Mexico. They arrive here. They are exhausted. All they want to do is get something to eat, get something to drink, rest, and then continue their migration.
But if they're constantly being disturbed by the cleanup activity,
they're not only not eating, but they're wasting calories trying to get away.
They can also be spooked from their nests by activity, leaving eggs and young vulnerable to predators. Workers here say they're doing their best, limiting trips to and from the island, being careful with vehicles, and enforcing a flight ceiling on helicopters so they don't disturb the birds.
What we're looking at here is the whooping cranes.
On a boat tour around the shore, fish and wildlife biologist Jeremy Edwardson points out the rarest of those birds. Around 300 whooping cranes winter here, and many have not yet left for their summer grounds in Canada. Right as they leave, the Kemp's Ridley sea turtle arrives. That's also an endangered species. It lays its eggs on the same beaches, now oily beaches, where the response crews are working. I asked Edwardson what the long-term impacts of the spill could mean for all those animals.
I don't think we'll ever understand it to the extent possible. There's some stuff that we can document, and it's easy to document, but also there's potential for the oil to be here for years.
He says that means the response could last just as long. Reporting on energy and the environment for State Impact Texas, I'm Mose Bouchel in Austin.
The U.S. House of Representatives passed legislation recently that restricts the president's ability to establish national monuments and parks. It faces an uphill battle if it's to become law, but conservationists are concerned that the bill sends the wrong message as a political battle over drilling in national parks is taking place. From Marfa Public Radio, reporter Lauren Madelon has the story.
And you can see this is a large boulder here, and this entire surface from one end all the way to the other has petroglyphs etched into it.
We're in Big Bend National Park in West Texas. It's 1,800 miles away from the U.S. Capitol, but a recent vote there has conservationists worried. That issue is the Antiquities Act. It gives the president authority to protect objects of historic interest. In 1908, President Teddy Roosevelt used the law to establish what is today Grand Canyon National Park. This is Roosevelt's great-grandson, Ted.
When it has been used, it's been used remarkably effectively.
Eight Democratic and eight Republican presidents have used the act.
It would be a tragedy, in my opinion, to see it stripped slowly but surely and die a slow death. Given the benefit the country has had from it.
Critics charge the legislation is a Republican snub of President Obama. Since 2011, he's used the act 10 times to create national monuments, including two in New Mexico and California. The bill's sponsor, Utah Republican Representative Rob Bishop, said in a statement he wants to end, quote, abuse by some presidents who aim to limit activities on lands. And just as the House was crafting its bill, Texas Republican Congressman Pete Olson expressed dismay, saying energy reserves can't be tapped because they lie inside national parks. This all comes after a decade of rising graffiti, theft, and vandalism here and at parks across the Southwest, such as Joshua Tree in California and Saguaro in Arizona.
These go back at least 3,000 or 4,000 years.
National Park Service archaeologist Tom Alex is checking petroglyphs, lines drawn by the ancients into rock. He's checking damage in this epic Texas landscape of desert and mountains hugging the Mexican border.
We had some graffiti here just in the last few weeks that showed up over spring break. I think America is a young country, having traveled in Europe, where you walk into a cathedral that's 800 years old and you realize what it took to build that and the fact that there's just not the sensitivity, the ingrained knowledge in our society that you see in a lot of the rest of the world. And so they just scratched right through the prehistoric images here.
Alex enters a natural shelter with clear evidence of human habitation. He points to ethereal black lines in the rock.
You can see this represents childbirth. This is an adult with a child between its legs.
Alex mentions that he regularly meets with 11 Native American tribes who see the sacred in this protected land.
Considering it that way, you think about walking into a spot like this, it's like walking into a cathedral. And would you go up to the altar on the cathedral and write your name all over it, or would you rip off the candlesticks that are the candelabra, the cloths that cover that altar? Would you steal that stuff and walk away with it?
Alex is an archaeologist, not a politician. But he says the move by the House and rising vandalism both send the same message, that conservation isn't the priority it once was. I'm Lauren Madelon in West Texas.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us about the show at texasmatters@tpr.org. And you're also welcome to comment on the show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.